17, section 2. And the main point here is that a democratic society requires the active participation of its citizens, you guys. And what does that mean? Unpack that. And so some of the terms that we'll see today, like authoritarian, dissident, extremist, even propaganda, these are terms that you need to understand because these are things that are happening in the world around us right now. First question. Let's think about the internet today. Does it cause more division? Does it cause less division? Or can it ultimately bring people together? You know, and really, that question is an individual one for each one of you. If you choose to allow it to cause division, it'll cause division for you. If you choose to allow it to build community, it will build community in a way that, you know, history has never seen before. But again, it can also cause division in a way that history has never seen before. And so it can be a tool or it can be a curse. And it's up to you which it will be. So as we look at divisions in society, particular to the internet, I want to help you understand how the internet can actually become a tool of authoritarian governments. And by authoritarian, I mean a government in which one leader or group of people hold near or absolute power. So how can an authoritarian use the internet, which is supposed to be, you know, the World Wide Web, right? It's supposed to be all the ideas in the world. But how can an authoritarian who is hoping to push their ideas use this powerful tool, which is supposed to empower you all with all the world's information, to force their ideas upon you? And I think that's the scary thing that we have to understand, is that it's being used for people to push their ideas down to you. So, a couple things. Number one, full-on authoritarian governments, like say China or North Korea would be the extreme, limit political discussions online. They build electronic borders. You know, with China, there is a nationwide version of our web filter. You know, like at the school web, if you Google certain things, it gets blocked. Well, the same is true for the entire nation of China. So they have electronic borders. They have controlled access to certain websites that don't fit their political agendas. For example, human rights groups. There are groups that hang out on the border of South and North Korea, and they attach flash drives and CD-ROMs to small balloons, and they float them over the border. They do it all the time. And it's certainly unorganized because they don't often have contacts on the other side, but we've seen evidence that some of this digital content has made it over the border and is being consumed by the citizens of North Korea. And what are they putting in there? They're putting movies, music, interesting things that young people like. Why? Because the citizens of North Korea have restricted access to the outside world. And so, sure, I mean, they could put leaflets about political ideas and so forth. You know, they could put copies of the Constitution in there. But what's more powerful is the Avengers movie. What's more powerful is, you know, the latest top 10 of pop music. What's more powerful is the fun stuff that people consume that the citizens of North Korea are having to ask themselves, why can't I watch the Avengers movie? Why can't I listen to that CD? And so, also authoritarian governments will shut down websites that are publishing information that they disagree with. And that's where you see the term dissident. Someone who disagrees with the established political or religious system could be considered a dissident. Now, in our country, we encourage a plurality of ideas. But yet, in authoritarian cultures, those who follow the counterculture, even in a democratic society like our own, can be ostracized. Those who follow the counterculture, even in a democratic society, can experience ostracizing. You know, I just saw a statement from John L. Lewis. Do you guys know who he is? He is like the living Martin Luther King. He actually marched with Dr. King. He's an amazing man. He's still a public speaker. He's old as dirt, but he still travels around. And he just made a statement recently that he's been beaten and arrested dozens of times. He's had his skull split open just for voting as a black man. And he said he knows what it means to suffer to vote. And he really needs people to vote, good or bad, to just vote. Because once upon a time, that was the counterculture, was to vote as a black man. And even in our democratic society, those were viewed as dissidents, which is certainly evidence of an authoritarian nature in our own culture. Okay, the internet. How can it be dangerous? This is not as true in our society. You know, even today, homeless folks have some means of accessing the World Wide Web, whether it's at a public library or some type of public Wi-Fi in a downtown. You know, most everyone has the ability to access the World Wide Web. And so this is something that's changed in the past 10 years. But this has not. The ability to empower extremist groups. Now, by extremist group, I mean an organization that promotes an idea that's furthest from the political center. Okay, so what's a centrist idea? So let's say in terms of college, you know, maybe far to the right would be make it so expensive that you must really, really, really want it to go. Maybe far to the left, make it absolutely free. The centrist idea is kind of in the middle. Let's make it reasonably priced. Okay, that's a centrist idea. Now, what's an extremist idea? Let's blow up colleges. You know, what's an extremist idea? Let's shut down public schools. Let's go back to privatized education. That would be an extremist idea. Well, guess what? There are folks that want to shut down public education. There are. They're out there. And guess what? You can go to their website, and they can publish it completely free of charge. I mean, Google Sites will allow you to host a site for no charge whatsoever. You can put all kinds of weird stuff on there. You can push all kinds of stuff out on vlogs, on blogs, on social media, etc., even if it's extremist. And that gives them power. And that gives them an audience. People become radicalized through online content. Again, yes, there are radical leftists, there are radical right. But the internet can also be an invasion of privacy. And we all understand this at this point. I mean, you agree to a certain infringement upon your privacy by virtue of owning a smartphone. I mean, this device is tracking everything you do. I mean, it's tracking your location right now. It knows where you are. You know, we just heard from the sheriff that EMS can use this to pinpoint your location, even if you didn't use it to make the phone call. It's kind of creepy, but it's also kind of helpful. You know, it serves a dual purpose, but you just understand that's an invasion of your privacy. Now, obviously this bullet has changed. You know, in the 1990s, early 2000s, to have internet at home was certainly a luxury. Today, it's becoming more of a public utility. In fact, there was even a movement during the Obama administration to designate internet access as a public utility, treating it just like electricity, meaning it would open up public funds to provide high-speed internet access even to places where it would not normally be affordable. There's an ongoing movement in terms of the public utility of Wi-Fi access or internet access, so to speak. But in the meantime, schools and libraries provide free access to internet. I mean, this is the high-speed internet access that I've ever had. It's right here in this building. And I mean, we hope that someday that high-speed internet access will expand and become more affordable and maybe even a public utility. But for right now, schools and libraries provide that opportunity. Okay, so previously, extremist groups were isolated. And by extremist groups, I mean, again, organizations that promote ideas that are far from the political center. You know, take the white nationalists, for example. The white nationalists are a group that you may have never heard of before Charlottesville. But after Charlottesville, they gained a lot of political traction. Yes, they did a really terrible thing at Charlottesville. Somebody drove a car into a crowd. But honestly, that got them a lot of attention. And that got people talking about them. And that's absolutely what they want. And their website traffic skyrocketed after Charlottesville. Go figure, right? No such thing as bad news. Or bad press, I mean. The internet enables extremists to find one another and connect. And they can spread their propaganda. By propaganda, I mean certain ideas that involve misleading messages designed to manipulate people. I was in Kentucky this weekend. I was paddling on a river called the Russell Fork. And there's a bridge there. It's an old bridge, an old railroad bridge left over from the coal era. And all over the bridge is graffiti, such as like KKK all the way, and then it gets worse from there. And say 50 years ago, that was how people connected with one another, was through written media, written messages. Maybe not on bridges, but just through leaflets. It was much more of a difficult process to connect these people with one another, where now they can make a post, and then they have friends. Yes. Mm-hmm. So, after Charlottesville, groups like the White Nationalist Movement saw a surge in recruitment. And they do a lot of their recruitment online. And even, hate groups in the United States are doing that. Even terrorist groups, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, are doing that. They're doing a lot of their recruitment through the internet. Now, the internet can be a powerful tool. But to be honest, it can also weaken unity by giving us the feeling that we're all divided and hate one another. It really can. You know, all you have to do is go to some type of political outlet, look at the comments section, and then, you know, our discussion of bots. I mean, how many of these comments are actually from real people? I don't know. But it can give us that feeling of division. And remember, division benefits certain groups. Now, criminals can even use the internet to commit cyber crimes. You know, the proliferation of child pornography has been made easier than ever through the internet. And while it can sound like gloom and doom, the internet can also promote free speech. It is also a safeguard, a bastion of your right to produce your ideas and to develop those ideas free from restriction. The next thought is the internet is a threat to privacy. You understand when you consume the internet, when you engage in online communication, you are relinquishing a number of your rights to privacy. Obviously, you know, I hope by now, that websites collect your personal information. You know, when we went to the botornot.org, there's a little pop-up that says, by the way, this uses cookies. And hopefully you know by now that cookies are a way of a website collecting your personal information. It's tracking your usage on that site. It may not be finding out your address, but to the extent of the law that they're allowed, they're tracking your information. And in many cases, these websites could be collecting your age, your address, your income, etc. For example, when you created your little account for SAS curriculum, or maybe even iCivics, you know, out of convenience, you may have just hit the red Google button. I did. Well, do you know what you're giving them when you hit the red Google button? You're giving them your email and any personal information that you've given to Google. Your name, your age, maybe even your physical address. And now, granted, they are required by law to disclose what information they're accessing, but you're giving away your information, and that's a commodity. Why, you know, what do they benefit from that? Well, your personal information is worth money to them, and they can sell that. They can use that in advertising. And so the more you use the internet, the more you are giving your personal information to groups that are monetizing that. And so absolutely you need to be careful. Now, I hope you understand this by now. But anytime you give your personal information to a website, you need to understand, what are they going to do with that information? What does that mean? When you're communicating with each other online, that information is archived, is recorded. Forever, ever. All of it. There's no such thing as a truly private communication online. There's not. I mean, it's obvious here at school. You know, if Alyssa types, "I hate the world and I'll set it on fire" on her email, well, then I get a printout of it. Well, yeah, so I get a literal printout of it the same day. And Ms. Cottle will come here and hand me the piece of paper, and I'll have to pull this out and go, "You just typed this at 10:42. It's creepy, right? But you know that when you enter the guest Wi-Fi, you click the little accept button. That accept button means that all of your online activities through this Wi-Fi access point are monitored. Now, you agree to that every time you hit the accept button. Yeah, so if I were to Google, like, "How cool is Satan?", then I'll probably get a printout of it, you know, or something like that. Okay.
That was great.
So, what can this lead to? What's the negative of it? You know, I've given Google crazy amounts of personal information. To a degree, I trust Google. You know, I don't expect to have my identity stolen from Google. And I understand, though, that they are monetizing that personal information. You know, there's a reason that they're offering free or super cheap G Suite accounts to organizations, because they're collecting all of your personal information every time you hop onto your Google account or your Chromebook or whatever. And that can lead to identity theft or fraud. Yeah. Okay, so what legal protections do you have? Well, the Constitution does protect your right to privacy, absolutely. But you understand that you can voluntarily relinquish that right when you go to certain websites. You know, why is Fortnite free? Well, sure, they're making lots of revenue through in-app purchases. But you know what they're also doing? It's collecting your personal information and monetizing. I mean, granted, most of their revenue comes from the in-app purchases, but they're also collecting your personal information. Now, specific laws designed for your protection. The Children's Online Protection Act means that website companies must establish a privacy policy describing what information they collect from children and how they will use it, and must get permission from parents of children under 13 to gather that information. So, for example, when you guys set up your SAS curriculum account, you had to click a little button that either you were over 18 or you were not. And if you clicked not, then you had to get a parent to approve it. It sent them an email. Now, granted, most of you probably clicked you were over 18, and that's none of my business. But by law, they're required to have that safeguard. And if you clicked that you were not under 18, then it emailed your parents a link for them to approve your access to this site. And that's required by federal law. Okay. Government surveillance. The internet can be a powerful tool to fight crime and terrorism. I mean, there is software that can record your email address just because you are accessing an electronic device. I mean, the government has surveillance tools that are extremely powerful in gathering your personal information. And with a warrant, they can do all manner of things. But even through the Patriot Act, they can do those things if you're a suspected terrorist without a warrant. Now, some companies will hand over data to law enforcement agencies when requested. But these could be invasions of personal privacy. I don't know if you heard a year or so ago the famous case where Apple did not want to unlock the iPhone or hack the iPhone of the San Bernardino shooter. And the FBI was insisting because There could be a cell or a network of terrorists prepared to commit similar acts of violence, and they wanted to make sure that these people were acting in isolation, and they needed access to their phone, which would have given them access to all of their texts and all their message history and so forth, to be able to confirm whether or not these folks are part of a conspiracy to hurt more people. And Apple famously said, no, we're not going to give that information out. And it caused a lot of drama. Well, other threats. Your internet use is monitored here at school. Just be mindful of that. You know, they can, and if your parents request, your entire internet access history here at the school can be provided to them upon request. Everything you've ever looked up online through this Wi-Fi point, by law, can be provided in a printout for your parents. Just be mindful of that. You hit the accept button. You hit the accept button. You did. I don't want to know what you're looking up. None of my business. But because you're minors, it is the business of our school to know what you're looking at. We have to by law. Now, criminals can also intercept. I'm sure you've heard of phishing, P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G scams, where malicious emails can collect your personal information through the creation of fake accounts, etc. Yeah, I mean the Ethiopian.
The Nigerian prince.
Yeah, and so you know, many companies are collecting your personal information just when you go to their website. So be careful. Be careful. Now, again, protect you. Another law you need to know about is the 1996 Electronic Communications Privacy Act. This does provide legal protections for individuals, but then again, the U.S. The Patriot Act waives many of those protections if you're suspected of being a terrorist. A warrant's not necessary for that. Okay, so the Constitution, the Fourth Amendment, protects citizens from unreasonable searches or seizures. Unreasonable searches. Again, it has to be proven by a warrant. And so many civil rights groups have claimed that the Patriot Act gives the government too broad of enforcement powers when monitoring you. Let's say that the FBI suspected Dakota of being a terrorist. He wouldn't have to know about this. They wouldn't even have to provide evidence to a judge of this. They just have their reasons to suspect Dakota of being a terrorist. Well, they can now monitor all of his electronic use ever. They can access every website he has ever visited on any private server or public. They can access any communication that he has sent or received ever without a warrant. And again, some claim that's creepy and a violation of your rights of privacy. Okay. And the big idea here, of course, is that you possess certain rights. But, you know, there are also responsibilities that go along with that. And in particular to our discussion over the end. Much of this is changing rapidly. Of course, our availability to technology has changed rapidly even since I made this presentation. But there's a few terms that are still relevant, such as intellectual property, copyright, or even revenue. So a few academic terms that you'll see, nonetheless, and erode. What authority does the government have when it comes to your private use of the internet? What rights does the government have in terms of monitoring and surveillance, even when it comes to just hanging out on your phone when you're bored between classes, or even hanging out on your phone on your home Wi-Fi? First off, freedom of speech. When our founding fathers passed the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, guaranteeing our right to freedom of speech, also promising freedom of the press, also guaranteeing that the government was not establishing an official religion, and so many of those other things that are associated with free speech, they had no idea that one day there would be an internet. One day you would have the capacity to communicate simultaneously with people from all over the world. And that presents amazing opportunities, but it also creates a number of challenges. And so the internet has become a battleground for freedom of speech. You know, and so freedom of speech has been a very controversial issue. For example, the internet is a place where you can post any manner of content, anything that you can think of. And with that comes really sketchy material. Some of it offensive, some of it racist, some of it hateful, some of it pornographic, some of it just downright terrible. But if we protect freedom of speech, that means the bad stuff too. Now, at schools, schools retain the right to use filtering software. So like when you were doing research for your Superman project, a number of sites were blocked because perhaps those sites contained some rather sketchy content. It's not that you intended to find that sketchy content, but if a site has that and the school or the system deems that it is inappropriate for school consumption, then it is blocked. So filtering software is used commonly by schools, but it can also be used by your parents at home. Now, there are some guidelines for censorship of online speech. You know, remember the Tinker standard. If speech is harmful, and in regards to school, if speech is disruptive, even electronic speech can be either harmful or disruptive to society. The Supreme Court has limited laws in regarding to speech on the internet and has generally fought to keep internet speech free. All you have to do is go to the comments section on your social media and you can read the nasty things that people say to one another that, like it or not, are protected by freedom of speech. You know, one famous case in regards to internet use and freedom of speech is the Reno versus the ACLU. The American Civil Liberties Union is an interest group devoted to promoting and protecting freedom of speech in the United States. They also provide legal defense in civil rights cases, and in this case they challenged before the United States Supreme Court. The court's majority opinion was that speech on the internet should have the highest level of First Amendment protection, similar to that of books and newspapers. So when you publish content online, you know, this morning I shared a silly picture from when I was in college. I was standing on a car. It was kind of, you know, it was just dumb. Well, that post of this old picture of me standing on a car is protected by freedom of speech. You know, I have the right to post that. No one has the right to tell me they can't post that. And in a way, legally, according to the United States Supreme Court, publishing content online is legally the same as publishing a book or a newspaper. Congratulations, you're all journalists. If you've ever written content and posted it online, you have the same legal protections that journalists do, according to Reno v. ACLU. Now, in regards to schools, schools retain the right to limit student speech. And once again, that's where the Tinker standard comes in. We can regulate your speech if it serves an educational purpose. You know, I appreciate you for not shouting profanities in this room. I view it as unprofessional, so I tend to regulate that type of speech because it's inappropriate for classroom use. Now, the school has a responsibility to communicate those expectations publicly, which we do through our student handbook. And in our student handbook, it details acceptable speech and unacceptable speech. And once again, we retain those rights. But next comes copyright and intellectual property. Now, I'm old enough to remember when the internet first became widely available, and one of the first things we did with the internet once it became widely available was use it to steal information, particularly copyrighted information, music. And collectively, people had to learn, sometimes the hard way, how copyright works. Copyright is the owner's exclusive right to control, to publish, and even to sell original work. If you come up with an idea and you retain copyright privileges of that idea, it's yours. You have the right to make money off of even ideas, and that right is protected through copyright law. Now, this means intellectual property as well. That is, if you write an original work, you could potentially make money off of that. You know, this channel that I'm creating on YouTube just hit 10,000 views. That means I may soon see ad revenue for the content that I'm publishing. Now, any time when I publish content that contains others' work, I have to cite that, give credit for it, and then allow them to make money off of the work that I publish. So that's how copyright works, because if I'm using third-party media, like a movie clip, then that belongs to them. And so it's contained in the copyright citations, and they can make money off my work. So if you ever watch one of the US videos that has a movie clip in it, there might be an ad before that video. I'm not collecting that ad revenue. That goes to the copyright holder, whoever made that media clip that I'm using with their permission. Now, this can include songs. Again, it can include these videos. It can include, of course, movies or even books, poetry, art, anything. And even if you've created something and you want to make money off of that something, yes, you can write a book, you can self-publish, you could do one today and self-publish through Amazon, and you can make money off of that, perhaps. And all of that is protected through intellectual property. Now, the copyright owner, let's say Grace has written a book. Now, there's a process to getting it published, but she would become the owner of that material. Meaning she has the exclusive right to control how that information is displayed. Does she want to publish it? Does she want to sell it? Or does she not want to share it? Well, that's completely up to her. That means if she drew an amazing picture, she was just bored in class, so she drew this incredible picture. And it was so good that Becky saw it and was like, Grace, you should get that published. Oh my gosh. And Grace says, no, I just kind of drew that for fun. Well, let's say while Grace wasn't looking, Becky snapped a picture of it, posted it, and it was so good that someone contacts her from a media outlet and says, we'd like to buy that from you. Well, now if Becky sells that to the media without Grace's permission, that's a violation of copyright law. She's stealing intellectual property. Now, the internet makes this very difficult, right? You can Google almost anything and find it. You know, let's say you didn't want to go to the school's movie night to watch Spider-Man Homecoming. Let's say Leia was like, you know what? I can just Google it at home.
That's a lot harder with movies. With old TV shows, it's easy.
Yeah, and with newer movies, it is difficult, but with enough time and enough diligence, she might be able to find a copy of it somewhere. Now, they get taken down all the time. Movies do have to budget to enforce copyright violation. But let's say she finds it. She watches it. She has just stolen intellectual property. But here's the thing. Leia, and it's just unfortunate that the internet has made this possible, but Leia is one of millions of other people that are streaming that illegally. And so how do you prosecute that? You know, the old problem with prohibition was you can't just fill up the jails with half the country. So if everybody's stealing intellectual property, it makes enforcement difficult. It doesn't mean that it's right to do so. It just means that stopping it is very, very difficult. Napster is before your time, but it was developed in 1999. It was an online music streaming and download service. It's kind of like the forward pass in football. So the internet is now widely available. Great. Well, one of the first things that popped up was a way to download music illegally. But since no one had ever seen anything like this, no one really knew what to do about it. Artists complained. I mean, Dave Matthews and Metallica both led the charge in complaining and trying to get this stopped. Because suddenly, instead of having to buy CDs, instead of actually having to purchase content from the producer, all I have to do now is Google a song, bloop, download, burn to CD, play it in the car. Now, of course, the technology we have is far more sophisticated today. But it still works the same way. If you want illegal content and you're willing to take the risk, it's not likely you'll get caught. So all you have to do is bloop, download. Well, here's the thing. It's so difficult to prosecute because so many people break that law that all the government can really do is go after the providers. As a consumer, it's going to be tough to catch you because there's so many of you. But a provider, well, that's a target that we can go after. It's like the drug war. If you went out and purchased illegal drugs today, the likelihood of your ever being caught is slim. Gotta break it to you. That is, to be honest, that's one of the underlying problems of the drug war. Enforcement has been difficult. However, the providers are the ones in which law enforcement has often expended incredible resources to catch. Because if we can catch the providers, the hope is we can limit the amount of illegal content. And that's where Napster came in. Napster was sued for breaking copyright law and was forced to shut down. But here's where it gets complicated. So Napster was a provider of the world's content. And I remember when it came out. I remember using it. No one even really understood if it was right or wrong, illegal, not. Eventually it was shut down. Well, next came peer-to-peer sharing. How do you control for that? Let's say that Michaela has the newest Justin Bieber album. She's digging it. She's loving some Justin Bieber. Well, let's say that Ritter is just super excited about Trantham's new Justin Bieber album. She says, hey, can I make a copy of that? Well, here's the thing. It's really simple to do. She puts the CD into the computer. Drag and drop, boom, she now has the new Bieber album. And so they're both bumping a Bieber, and what are we supposed to do? That didn't even get registered in the school's online activity. She just put it in the PC, didn't even have to be connected to the internet. She downloaded the file to her hard drive, and she's got the new Bieber album. That's called peer-to-peer sharing. How do you catch that? It's really tricky. Well, guess what? There's a number of services that even exist providing that. Like, let's say you want to share it, but you don't have the CD, but you've got it uploaded to a device at home. You can send it through sites like Grokster. They have weird names. They change all the time because it's an illegal activity. Because you're sharing content that a professional created with the hope of making money off of it, but you're sharing it for free. And again, peer-to-peer. Once again, difficult to prosecute. Okay, so what laws do exist in regards to this? The Digital Millennium Copyright Act makes it a crime to bypass computer codes protecting copyright. There is software out there that will let you rip movies onto your hard drive. And that is a crime. You know, now it's simple. If I want to add a media clip, I go to a YouTube, I download it. When I upload it as one of these videos, I give credit. I allow them, I consent to allow them to put ads on these videos and make revenue off of it, and everybody's happy. Back in the day, I might have been able to rip the DVD onto a file and use Movie Maker to cut the scene that I wanted from the movie and then to upload that manually. It's the same process. And through fair use guidelines, I can do that legally as long as I give credit. And as long as if I publish that content online, I allow them to collect ad revenue off of it. Okay, so the next question is, how do you tax online shopping? You know, while we were in DC, we went to the mall a lot. Some of you guys enjoyed it, some of you shopped and bought things. I bought nothing. I bought food. I'm kind of an old grump when it comes to coming to the mall. But meanwhile, I did walk around, did look at some things, and I'm like, ooh, that's cool. Maybe I'll buy that on Amazon later. Well, how does Amazon shopping work legally? So online shopping is easier than it ever has been, right? It's amazing. I love it. It's super convenient. I have this app on my phone. If I want something, I hit a button, and it shows up at my house in 2 days. It's great. I love Amazon Prime. Well, the question is, how do you tax that? Where's that money go? You know, if you go and shop at Mass General Store and you buy something cool, maybe it's a new hat or a shirt, well, that tax revenue is collected on behalf of Henderson County. That helps make our schools great, it helps repair the roads, the potholes that you're dealing with, all that money stays here, not to mention supporting a local business. But if you walk in there and you see the nice thing, and you do, which we all do this, right? You hop on Amazon and you go, oh, it's cheaper there. Walk out of the store, hit the button, it shows up at your house. Well, the problem is that's lost revenue for Henderson County. That's lost revenue for Mass General Store. It saves you money. So that means that while Toys R Us just declared bankruptcy, Amazon is a multinational conglomerate. And the owner of Amazon is one of the wealthiest men in the world. Toys R Us, my happiness as a kid. Amazon, because even though you may be local shopper, super ethical person, you're in the minority. Most of us vote with our wallets. Most of us are gonna choose the cheaper option, because I mean, seriously, we got bills to pay. So that means revenue, which is the income that the government collects for public use, is going to be lost for Henderson County, because where does it go? Well, it goes to Amazon. How is it collected? Well, recently, even since the publication of this, recently federal laws were passed ruling that you now have to pay the state sales tax from the state in which you purchased it. So let's say that you buy it here. Well, we have a lower sales tax. But guess what? If you go down to South Carolina, then you hit the Amazon button, you pay less. Why? Because South Carolina has lower state taxes. Well, let's say that you drive over to Tennessee and then you hit the Amazon button. Well, they have a higher state tax. So, meaning depending on where you live, the state now has the right to collect that revenue even from online commerce. Okay. That means that now states are collecting taxes, because when Amazon first came out, they didn't have to charge any taxes, which was great. If you're a shopper, of course I'm going to buy stuff online because I don't have to pay any tax. Yay! Instead of going to the store and having to pay lots of taxes. Now, since we're at school, let's talk about how the internet works at schools. You know, the internet at school is great. It's the highest speed internet that I have access to. I'm going to go back up my photos real quick because I forgot to do that. Since I do it at home, it shuts down our internet. I do it here at school. It's going to be done by the time I'm finished with this lesson. Yay. But while that's great, I can back up my photos. It also creates a number of problems. And we've got to figure out how to allow you to use this amazing resource that is the internet without causing problems. So the Children's Internet Protection Act requires all schools to follow these guidelines. All schools have to provide filtering software that block dangerous or offensive materials. So if you were to try to watch a movie illegally here at school, it's going to be blocked. If you were to try to do research about the Nazis, well, some of that might be blocked, even though you're trying to do academic research. And that's because our school is required to comply with the Children's Internet Protection Act. Filtering software obviously can monitor traffic. It can also block traffic. And we are required by federal law to keep a record of every website you have ever visited, every email you have ever sent, every little thing that you type on Google Doc. Occasionally I get printouts of really creepy things that you type to one another, and I have to deal with those as a behavior issue. Even if they're in some comment thread from some private server thing that you're using. I'm like, oh, Alyssa wrote that at school. Okay, you know, gotta go deal with sketchiness. Come on, Alyssa. This is what you wrote. Here's a printout of what you typed at 3:30 p.m. from the school's Wi-Fi about how you're gonna do creepy things. Awesome. Alyssa didn't actually do that, but yeah. Now, your parents want to know what you're up to. Here are the rights they have, and here are the rights you have. Let's say your parent comes and you're like, oh my gosh, Leia's been so much trouble at home. We don't know what she's up to anymore. I want a printout of everything that Leia has done on the internet here at school. Okay. What rights did the school have? What rights does Leia have? Well, the court ruled that parents can actually look at your activity. That means, okay, as Alan's parent, I want to see everything he's done on the internet since he's been here at school. He's been sketchy at home. I bet you he's sketchy at school too. So, they can see everything he's typed. But the identities of the people he is communicating with are protected. They cannot be revealed.